Mike Lorenz, alcoholic. Dried eight, September 7th, 1985, and that's not a particular distinction here, but it stuns people that watched me come and go from Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a few years. Matter of fact, I sponsor the son of the guy who gave me what I hope is my last start-over token, and Bob Sr. whispered to me when he gave it to me that if it was necessary to give me another one, it would be in suppository form, since apparently the current method of application wasn't working. I want to thank Bob for the introduction, for the invitation to be here. This is a fabulous place, and I've been fortunate enough to be at all of the state lines since the first one, not up here, but out where you are, and for most of those. And this is, you know, they talk about knowing the holidays are coming with Black Friday after Thanksgiving. I know the holidays are coming when I'm at state line. You know, this is where it's at for me, and I get to see so many people I admire. And when Bob asked me to participate this year, some time ago, that was the honey, and I've been anticipating the honey ever since. And last night, Marilyn explained it. Now I got to eat my honey. So we'll see if we can get that done. Frank promised me this morning that, in fact, he promised both of us that he was going to lower the bar, and I think he's lied about other things too. I'm not sure. It's good form to, I guess, establish the fact that I didn't drink well. And I grew up, I live in Indianapolis now. I grew up in a little college town in Iowa, not far from Mike's home group. And just a picture, I'm a teenager. This is the mid-60s, and out in the country, they don't have two-man patrol cars yet. So I get pulled over I'm out drinking with one of my buddies. We got a six-pack or two in the car, and the lights come on behind me, and the sheriff's deputy, Barney Fife, is pulling me over. And I turn to my buddy, and I tell him, I says, "Watch this." And I got out of the car, and I walked back toward the deputy with a big smile on my face, and I proceeded to disarm him. And then I turned around and handed him his gun back. Thank God it wasn't Frank. You'd have a different speaker today. But see, I made a calculation. I needed to be somebody. And I figured, and I didn't want to be in trouble, and I figured if I could take the guy's gun away, but give it back to him, he would be too embarrassed to write me up and take me back to the sheriff's station and admit in front of all his buddies that the kid took his gun away. And more importantly, or just as importantly, my friend was watching, and you can bet that story was all over my high school the next morning, you know, and I was the guy. And that's kind of my drinking really never got much better than that. I tend to think in images, and up till this point, what I think we've been doing is sort of like packing a parachute. I went to some military training at a place called Fort Benning, colloquially known as Benning's School for Boys, and they took us into a hangar down there, and they said, "We're going to show you men how to pack parachutes." And so I started learning how to pack parachutes, and we packed those chutes, and we were doing it for a while. And you know how any time you do a repetitive task, it gets kind of boring, you don't pay much attention to it. Finally, one day, they said, "Those chutes you just packed, grab them, we're going to go jump them." And that's what, and you all of a sudden start thinking real hard about, you know, now, were those shroud lines straight? Were the panels, were they, all that stuff. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I tell my guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every day, whether you know it or not, you're packing a chute here that you're going to get to jump someday. Because someday a loved one's going to die. Someday you're going to lose your job. Someday something's going to happen. And if you've been putting junk into that parachute packing business, you're going to be in real trouble. So what we've been doing up to this point is we've been preparing ourselves. You know, all this stuff, my just a offer to turn my life over to God. It's my friend Clint pointed out to me, it was the offer doesn't really mean anything until there's some real consideration with it. You know, I've made offers that I haven't fulfilled all my life, and so I have to take the actions of writing inventory and fifth step in that inventory and then becoming entirely ready before I get to start to be about the business of cleaning up some of the messes I made to the best that I can, that's possible to do. I have a God of informed consent. And what that looks like for me is one of my real reluctances about turning my will and my life over to the care of this God that I understood or didn't understand or thought I understood or was afraid I understood was that I was going to be changed into something I didn't want to be. And Mike and I had a mutual friend, Don, that said, "Oh, no, Mike," he says, he's a gentleman. He will not change you without your consent. And I didn't know much about that in the beginning, but I've come to experience that over time. See, what I do is I write the inventory. I get clear on who I've been or who I thought I was. And I get clear about all of this. And then once I'm clear about that, then I can sincerely come to a place where I'm gladly ready to have God change me into whatever He thinks is best. It's no longer Mike's vision for Mike. It's God's vision for Mike. And where that really became clear for me was I was laying in a gurney outside an operating room in 2003. And I had this cancer problem. And, you know, it's 4:30 in the morning, apparently the only time they do surgery. And I'm naked under the sheet and this orderly, this resident, I guess he was, came up to you with a clipboard and he said, "Mr. Lorenz," he says, "we're going to take you in there. We're going to open you up. And if we find this, we're going to do this. And we find that, we're going to do that. And this may cause this problem and this may cause that not to function and this and that and the other thing. And do you consent to this operation?" They did not ask my advice on performing the surgery. They didn't ask my, you know, anything but do you consent? And that's where I'm getting to this place. See, what I actually said to that guy was, I don't know where it came from, was just, "Thy will be done." Business of step eight is one of the places that my sponsorship relationship is dearest to me. I wouldn't consider making an amend without running it by my sponsor and running it by my sponsor in depth. And I've been so lucky because I've had people that not only will... See, I know if I've written a good inventory, I know sort of what I did. I don't know what it did to people. I don't know what the real implications of my actions were. And my one of my first attempts at an amend came with my old business partner. And I got sober in Indianapolis, and I was real broke and everything else. And this guy lived in North Carolina. And every time I tried, I couldn't afford to go see him. So every time I tried to call him, all I got, and once he found out who was there, it was a click and a dial tone. And I didn't understand why none of that was happening. Now, when I finally got sponsored and when I finally started getting some real direction around this, the clouds started to part a little bit, and I started to figure out what in the world had really happened here. What had happened here is that I'd stolen money from Stuart. I'd lied to him. Cheated him. I'd done all this kind of stuff. But what I'd really done is I'd broken his heart, and I didn't see it. And so my attempt to send him a check was a damn insult. Not that I didn't need to pay the money back, but this guy took me into a business years ago. He had a son the same age I was, and that son wanted to be in that business, and he said no to his son and yes to me. And when I was starting to have trouble due to my drinking in that industry, he was one of the people that stood up and defended me and would keep working with me even when other people had turned their back on me. And I paid him back by telling some of our customers and clients that the reason that there were problems and things weren't happening the way that I'd promised they should happen and everything has happened was because he was getting old and incompetent and was losing it. And I was doing the best I could to keep the business together. I put a knife right in that man's back. Now, can you imagine handing somebody a check to make that okay? But I didn't see it until I worked with good sponsorship. The sponsor had me in this case since I couldn't go there and since he wouldn't have been willing at that time to see me anyway. What he asked me to do with Stuart is he says, Mike, just start, you've got his address, just start writing him letters. Write him a letter every month or two. And I did that for 4 years, and it was just like dropping a penny down a well and never hearing it hit bottom. Nothing. Finally, I got an answer to one of those letters somewhere here. Oh, yeah. Dear Stuart, I was watching the North Carolina-Michigan game last night, and I was thinking to you, the fact is I do that pretty often because you've been very important in my life. First things first, by the grace of God, I haven't had to take a drink, pills, et cetera, since September 7th, 1985. And for that, I'm more grateful than I can say. This isn't a personal triumph, but the triumph of the love of many people, including yourself. I thank you. I imagine that this doesn't sound much like me. I hope not, because that person brought a lot of pain into people's life, including yours. It's not necessary for me to try to be a big shot anymore. I failed in each and every area of my life, and for that I have no one to blame except myself. I can't believe I've been given a new life. Stuart, I don't expect anything from you, not even forgiveness. I just want you to know that I love you and that you're in my prayers every day, and if I can ever do anything for you, please don't hesitate to let me know. And this is 4 years in. Finally, I get the letter back. Mike, how happy I am to hear from you. It's been some time, pal. I think of you often. The best news is that you've been given a new life and appear to appreciate it. I'll call you soon, and maybe you can bring me up to date. Please take care. Love, Stuart. And that became, and of course, a nice, I did need to pay the money back and all that other stuff. But the real harm was breaking his heart. And without the aid of that sponsor and everything else, I was getting nowhere. I was getting nowhere. In fact, I came to see him, Stuart, and I talked about it later. He felt insulted to get a check. You know, what's that? A check? And what an insult for me. I mean, it's one thing for me to give a check to Shell Oil Company or a check to the phone company or something like that. It's another thing for me to come to you when we've had a relationship and put a price on your pain, and after I calculate it, and even if I'm generous and hand you something, and I think that should make the pain go away. I had the amend where I had been harmed, or so I thought, anyway. I had my mother's sister was married to a guy. They lived in New Jersey, just outside of New York, in a wealthy suburb, and they had no children, were not able to have children. And so I got, for a few years during my young years, I'd get farmed out to them on the summer. And that had its benefits because they were wealthy, and so I went to private swim clubs, and I went to the, private this and private that, and all over New York City and all that kind of stuff, and tea at the Rainbow Room and with Vincent Lopez in the orchestra and all this kind of stuff that a young guy from Iowa City is never going to see. But my I'm still a little alcoholic, and I'm a snot, and one day I'm sitting at breakfast with my uncle, and they bring me my eggs, and I tell them I want to send the eggs back because I think the yolks are too runny. And my uncle had enough of my crap, and he just hauled off and smacked me and gave me a bloody nose. And I turned him into a, did my best anyway, to turn him into a pariah in our family. I let my grandfather know, I let my mother know, who was always my defender, and everything else, and all this. So that was the short version of what my injury was. Now, I came back as a teenager and paid him back by breaking into their house, their liquor store cabinets, vomiting all over the house, and, having it. So when I came back from Vietnam, I was at we had a family picnic and so forth, and that aunt and uncle were visiting in town, and I waited until he was walking around the side of the house, and then I took him and I pinned him upside the garage, and he's getting to be pretty old by this time. And this young guy out of combat just has now got him by the throat up against the garage and asked him if he'd like to try smacking me again now. And I terrified him. And as much as anything I particularly did to him, it was the damage that did within our family. People didn't talk to each other about some of that stuff. And I held off and held off and held off and would not make amends to him. First, my justification was that, he got what was coming to him. And the second thing was, is they've got all this money and they're getting old. And if I make amends to him, it's going to look like I'm trying to suck up and get in the will. And see, I've got that image to protect. So I can't make amends to him. And finally, my sponsor got through to me and says, look, he says, you've made all these other men. Why the hell are you hanging on to this piece of crap? And so they're old by this time. When I sent this letter, my aunt and uncle were 85 years old. My aunt was the type of person that we didn't have dinner plates. They were underliners. And she would say, decorum, Michael, decorum. Don't talk that way. So I was taught always to approach them in a manner and language that would make them comfortable. Hence, no phone call or anything like that. Dear Virginia and Phil, I'd hoped to have this conversation with you in person, but I've already waited far too long, and who knows when our paths may cross again. Many things have changed in my life, but my handwriting isn't one of them, so I'm typing this to make sure it's legible, not less personal. They came from a class where a typewritten note is an insult often, and not considered personal. I want to specifically acknowledge my boorish behavior around and towards you and my failure to express gratitude for your kindness and generosity over the years. I was wrong. I'm particularly pained to recall my self-centered, immature behavior because it so appallingly fails to reflect the love and gratitude that my heart holds for you both. I want you to know that the gifts you gave me of your time, travel, education, and love have made my life much richer than it otherwise would have been. I often recall our trips to the city, Radio City, Rockefeller Plaza, the Rainbow Room, Washington, D.C., the Shoreham, Mount Vernon, the Smithsonian, etc., etc. I learned to enjoy great music from your record collection and saw great homes and great art. What priceless gifts. Thank you. If you can ever think of any way which I can add to your lives, please don't hesitate to let me know. I'd be delighted to even return a small portion of the love you've given me for these many years. And I got a response in a healing. My uncle and I didn't start playing golf all of a sudden and going fishing together, but the relationship had shifted. And that was just barely in time, because about a month and a half later, that aunt who appeared well died suddenly. And so I almost missed my chance to take care of that. And oddly enough, just before I came here, I got a call from that uncle. He's 99 years old now. And he wanted me to know that they just sent him home from the hospital, that he's going to die soon. There's nothing more they can do for him. I knew the healing was complete because I was one of the people he would personally give that information to. And so it goes on. It's amazing. I need to stay out of drama when I do this and not cause further harm to others. I often get the guys I sponsor want to come to me and talk to me about living events. And the answer I give them, and I don't know if it's the correct answer or not, but it's the answer that's worked for me, is yes, I have to live out my amends, but they are not a substitute for making the amend. Now, not every amend have I been able to make, and I'm so spiritually blind, it's interesting. I got caught up short. There was a story I used to tell from the podium about being in a corporate training apartment down in Louisville, Kentucky many years ago. And I shared that apartment with a guy I didn't particularly like. I nicknamed him Richard Reefer. I'm a Vietnam vet. He was what I perceived to be a dope-smoking hippie. And I came home one night. And he's out strumming. This apartment was on the sixth floor of a high-rise apartment building. I came home one night, and he's doing what he does and strumming the guitar out on this little patio we have. And I had that red flash, and I went across the room without saying a word, and I just put my shoulder into him and took him off over the edge of that thing. And I grabbed his feet, and I'm holding him upside down six floors up over the pool apron. And I pulled him back in, and there was no more drama to it than that. And so I would tell this story from time to time, and it seemed just like kind of one of those funny, harmless drunk stories. So my dear Linda and I, we're down in Louisville. In 2004, our friend Don was down there doing a workshop on the traditions. We'd gone down to see Don, and we're driving along. I said, Linda, that's the apartment over there. That's the one. And she looks at me, oh, yeah. She says, how did you ever make amends to that guy? And I go, uh-oh. See, I'm so blind, I'm running around talking about amends, and I don't even get that. She says, well, what happened to that guy? Well, he resigned from the company and was never seen the next day, you know, and so on. So don't you think maybe you affected him and so on and so forth? So I sponsor Bales Bondsman, and he's good at skip tracing people, so we're looking for Richard Reefer out there. That company's bankrupt and gone, and the records don't exist, so we're having some problems, but that's one of those that, you know, I'm so blind I don't see. Another one that I need to make and may never be able to make in a direct fashion. I was in the Army, and I was in advanced infantry training unit out in Fort Ord, California. And these were temporary training units. They brought us together for 6 or 8 weeks of training, and we went through all this intense infantry stuff, and then they scattered us. Some of us went to Vietnam. Some of us went other places. So forth. There was a guy in this unit that had an unfortunate resemblance to Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler, and he immediately became Himmler, and he was the guy that was getting picked on, and I was the guy, one of the guys that helped pick on him, and it was relentless, and it was terrible. We'd mess his gear up before inspections, so he was always in trouble. He was always on restriction. Everything was always upside down for him. He didn't have any companionship. It was a form of shunning and isolation. People did things like making hangman's noose, and he slept on a lower bunk, and they'd leave the hangman noose hanging from the upper bunk, so he'd wake up with a noose in his face when he'd wake up. My little piece of that, I was coming home from the NCO club and down the beach there and found this small dead shark, and I put this dead shark in his bunk with him, and he woke up screaming when he found this. He was in bed with the shark. And, you know, a lot of what I do looks like the actions of a sociopath or a psychopath. But the fact is that these things trouble me. And without a drink, I can't live with this stuff. And so he just went on the list. And a year or so later, I was attending another retreat. And this retreat was not an Alcoholics Anonymous retreat. It was just a retreat of some men, and there was a guy that came in and was talking about men that had been damaged by other men. And there was a presentation in the afternoon, and he talked about this, and he said, "Now, is there anybody here who's been hurt by the actions of other men?" And this guy got up from the audience and walked up there, and you could tell from the way he walked that he had some physical impairment, and he told a story, and the story was essentially that he'd been a 14-year-old, a freshman in high school, and was out at the swimming pool that summer and minding his own business. And these jocks showed up, and they wanted to show off for the girls. So they started throwing him back and forth and kind of playing water polo with him for the ball and everything. And in the process of throwing him around, they caused this physical damage to him. And the facilitator turns to him and he says, "If you could get those guys in front of you right here, right now, what would you want to know? What would you ask them if you could?" And he said, thought about it, and he just teared up a little bit. And he said, "Well, I've never understood. Why did they do this to me? What did I ever do to them? I didn't even know them. I wasn't even in their school yet. What did I do?" And I found myself on my feet and standing by that guy and talking to him and saying that, you know, "I didn't do that to you, but through my own lack of character, I've done something very much like that. And here's what I did. And I want to tell you that the real reason I did that was I watched what was happening to you, and I knew if I didn't turn on you, they would come after me, and I knew I couldn't take it. So I joined the mob and went after you." and we had some more talks over that weekend. That seemed to be helpful to him. Now, that's the closest I've been able to come so far in God's world to straightening that piece of business out. Maybe in some world, someday I'll run into the guy. It'll happen. But since it was a temporary unit, there aren't any old buddies to write to and get names from or rosters from or emails or, you know, looking for Himmler on Facebook is not productive. And, my second sponsor did me a great favor. He fired me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not immediately. Well, I had my first 5 years are kind of what I recall as my junior guru phase. You know, I went to gazillions of meetings, grabbed every service position I could, quoted all the wise people I could listen to from one meeting to the next. But I'm almost completely unscarred by the actual recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result, I arrived at my fifth AA birthday more suicidal than I'd ever been when I'd been drinking. And my life looked fine on the outside, but I'm dying on the inside. And I liked Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved all those meetings and everything else. And my secret is I'd sit around at meetings and I'd look at you and I'd look at your smiles and I'd look at your lives and everything else. And it seems to work for you, but it just doesn't work for me. I like it. I wish it did. But see, what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous was what I did years ago when I went to the University of Iowa. I went over to the field house, signed up for all my classes, went and bought my books, joined a fraternity, threw the books in the closet, and started to party. Now, if you ran into me on campus and asked me what I was doing there, I would have said, well, sir, I'm a pre-law student here at the University of Iowa. And that's technically true, except I'm not going to class at the University of Iowa. And the same thing here. I didn't miss your dance. I didn't miss your party. I didn't miss your meetings. I was your GSR. I was whatever it was. But I haven't really experienced the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And along the way of the process, my junior guru thing, I found myself in a situation. No, nobody in this room would be able to relate to this, but I'm dating a married woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring her 16-year-old son. And I'm playing euchre on the weekends with her husband, and he's a gun-toting federal agent. And my sponsor came up to me and finally tackled me in the car, parking lot of the club, and said, look, every time I approach you about your behavior, you manage to explain it to me in such a way that it almost sounds like God's will. I know that's insane, so I can't have anything to do with you. And that got me. I had to change my behavior. And I always wanted to edit that story out of the talk. But I was told, number one, the only reason I wanted out of the talk was for my ego, and number two, that other people might not need to know that you can make serious, grievous errors around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober, and you don't have to drink or get shot because of them, but you do have to change your behavior, in my experience. With that background, I ended that relationship, eventually get into the step work, do the step work. I'm making amends to this gal. And she and the husband are divorced by this time. It was not because of us, but she's divorced. And so I made amends to her, and she said, something's happened to you. You've changed. You're not the guy I was dating. Well, I don't know. And she said, you know, I'm sponsoring a group of women, and I don't know how to do what you're doing. Would you do one of those things for us and take us through the steps? And I thought, oh, God, no. I thought I'm going to get off the hook. And so I called Denver up and said, Don, you know, surely this isn't appropriate. And he says, well, are you sexually interested in any of these women? And I said, no, not now. And well, and so he says, I think you can do that. So I did that, and I had a fabulous experience, because as it turns out, you couldn't tell it always from my behavior, but I'm a guy who really likes women. I think they're wonderful. I like everything about them. I think they make some of the world's best friends. Matter of fact, Don told me, he says, look, here's the rule, Mike. If it's got a motor attached to it, ask a guy about it. If it's got a feeling attached to it, ask a woman about it. They understand it, you know. And that's not bad advice. See, it's kind of like the computer deal. Sometimes what you see on the screen kind of looks the same, but it's like a Mac and a PC. The way they got the stuff on the screen, it's a completely different process. So I got to hear from these women what powerlessness from their standpoint really was like. And I got to understand and love them from an entirely different direction. And when it came time to do inventory and so forth, typically if I'm doing a workshop, I write mine first, and then I say, okay, here's mine, so you know what this looks like, tastes like, and smells like. It's Don. I says, surely I don't have to share inventory with these women. He says, well, share it with me. And he says, ah. He says, there's nothing there that's going to get damaged except your ego. You can share it. So I did. And I got more insight. In part of making amends to her, you know, I almost missed this piece, because I'm getting up ready to leave the coffee shop after I've made amends to her. And I said, oh, by the way, do you have Bill, her ex-husband? I said, do you have Bill's current contact information? I said, I don't know where he is now, and obviously I need to make amends to him. And she says, oh my God, please don't do that. He says, he knows nothing about what happened between you and me. And we've got children together. I'm going to be seeing him at weddings and funerals till one of us dies. I don't need that going on between the two of us. Please, please leave that alone. I said, okay. See, because I wanted to be a big shot and go back to my home group and say that I'd gone to the federal gun-toting federal agent and told him that I'd been messing with his wife and everything else, that, you know, I'd add another star to my lapel here, I almost caused further harm. Learned an important lesson from I'm spiritual. My real problem is spiritual blindness. I just don't. If you can give me the right question, I usually come up with the right answer. A number of years ago, I had a confrontation with a guy who thought I'd run a stoplight. I thought it was just kind of more pink than red, and he was angry with me. And he pointed over there. He says, "My daughter's in that car." He says, "Is your getting this parking place worth risking her life?" Never even thought about it. Never even thought about it. I'm not a sociopath. I'm not a psychopath. If I can get to the right question, would you risk a child's life for a parking place? Of course not. But see, I don't see that. I just see that it's my turn and it's crowded, and if I don't hurry up, then I'm gonna miss something I want. So the same thing with this other thing here. I want to talk about two more amends here, and then wrap it up. My dad had died by the time I got sober, and my dad was my hero. Now, it was a contentious relationship, primarily because of me. How do I describe it? My dad went to college on a football scholarship. He was, I resemble my mother. My dad was a big, dark-haired guy, played tackle. Tackles in the 30s weren't as big as they are today, but they were still big. And he went to college on it, and he was the kind of guy that he'd borrow something. He borrowed a tennis racket and won the city tennis championship. He would bowl a couple times a year and roll 250 and, you know, all this kind of stuff. He was a natural at anything he touched. And see, I had this old idea that in order for my dad to love me and to not be disappointed in me, I had to be able to beat him. And so I was always in competition with him. He and I won our city's father and son golf championship for a couple of years. And when I came back from Vietnam, he'd had a stroke while I was there, young man. And I took him out to play golf with him. And, you know, he'd always been this guy, hit the ball. He was on the edge of the green on a par four on his drive and all this kind of stuff. He wasn't supposed to walk again, but he's walking again without any braces or crutches because he trained out of that stroke the same way he trained for football. And he took me out and he just trounced me, you know. Shot a 42-39 and, you know, that was it. And I took my golf clubs when we finished that round. I hung them up in the garage at my parents' place and never touched them until my mother moved out of there 30 years later. I just quit, turned my back on the game. And he and I would come home as a teenager, and I was the one that I'd accused, invented a dysfunctional family, but I was the dysfunction. I would come home drunk. My mother would say something. I'd swear at her. My father would say, "Son, you're not going to talk to your mother like that." I'd take a swing at him, and he'd have mercy. He could have just decked me, but he'd try and restrain me, but I'm big enough that I can cause him some trouble. So we're rolling around on the kitchen floor. I'm trying to slam his head into a cabinet. And I'm the oldest of four. I got my younger brothers and sister are up, and they're crying, and they're upset, and they're afraid their dad and their big brother are going to hurt each other. I finally became willing to make amends to him because I'd been shown that in God's world there are no limits in space and time. I thought the grave had put him beyond amends, but I was wrong. So I was back in Iowa for Christmas at my mother's, and I called Don up to wish him a happy AA birthday. The 26th of December was his anniversary, and I called up to wish him happy anniversary, and I said, I'm finally going to do it, Don. I'm going to go out to the cemetery and make amends to my dad. And he says, "Mike, what do you want from this?" And I says, "Well, at this point," I says, I'm just dropping my end of the rope. All I want is forgiveness, if that's possible." And he says, "Mike, if you want forgiveness, you have to offer forgiveness." And the last piece came into place for me. And I drove out to that graveyard. And I'm still tempted to be a half measures guy because my image is important to me. A part of me says, I'm sitting here in the car. I can just do this from here because I can see the headstone from here. And of course, I didn't want to see anybody. I got this image. I don't want to be seen standing out in this graveyard talking to this tombstone. People think I'm crazy or something. But you trained me right then not to shut it. Shortcut the possibilities in God's world. And so I walked over to the grave, and I sat there, I stood there and I said, "Dad, you need to know I'm dropping my end of the rope. You're square with me. Now here's where I caused harm in our relationship." And I went through, of course, light and stills and all that and stuff and the violence. And worst of all, if I could get you and Mom fussing with each other a little bit, you weren't paying as close attention to what was going on with me. So here I am, a son, trying to actively cause some dissension in my parents' marriage. And see, I know what I did, but I don't know how it affected. And so I said, Dad, I'd like to become aware of what I need to know to get the books to balance between us. And I said a prayer and I left that graveyard. And I got home to my mother's house and I walked in and I looked over to the side and my dad's old desk was still sitting there. And I remembered the letters. One of the things I was pissed off about is, you know, he was just this buttoned up old guy out of the World War II and the Depression. And he was too cheap to ever call me. He had plenty of money. He wouldn't call me. And I remembered all the letters he wrote me. He wrote me letters every week, 3 pages, both sides of the paper, legal pad. And it all of a sudden occurred to me how much time and love it took to sit there and write those letters. And the same way that the kids are, you know, comfortable texting today, and that's the way they communicate. My dad was a man who learned to communicate. If you grew up in the Depression, you didn't sling long distance phone calls around, you know. But he loved me in the way he knew how, and I understood that. I told you he was this buttoned up guy. Another awareness came along. I remember he wasn't a feelings guy. He never told me how he felt or anything. And then I forgot. I'm back from Vietnam and I'm his war hero's son. And he sits down with me in the kitchen and tries to tell me what it feels like to be 48 years old and know he's not going to live a full life. And that he was worried about what was going to happen to my mother and the younger kids that are still at home. His life. And I'm his big tough son, and I was the one that stopped that conversation. Said, Dad, I don't want to hear about this, and walked out of the room. And see, what's happened over time is not so much as I found the truth, is that the lies that I'd put together all my life quit working for me. See, I've got this team of screenwriters running in my head all the time, still to this day. It's a tragedy, it's a comedy, it's a romance, it's this, it's that, and everything. It's amazing how little of my thinking has anything to do with reality. I mean, it's only incidental. And so, through you and through God only, I get rid of these pieces of fantasy. And I went on, and another thing I hated was that as part of his rehab from the stroke, they had him making things with wrought iron and stained glass and everything else. And he did some really beautiful sculptures and small sculptures and stuff. And one day he asked me if I would help him put some of those in some suitcases and carry those around. We'd go to the furniture stores and gift shops in our area, part of the country, and see if people would be willing to sell those things on consignment. And I did it, but I hated him for it. Those were the yuppie stores were my friend's shop, and he wanted me to go in here like a beggar with our stuff and please help our family and please buy our stuff. And he was doing this to humiliate me. And another one of my lies went away. All of a sudden, I understood that my father loved us so much that even as he was dying, he was willing to go to any lengths to try and take care of our family. And this went on for a period of time. And finally, one day, I'm just sitting in a meeting. The meeting wasn't about any of this stuff. And all of a sudden, I just had a rush of tears. And I wondered, what's happening to me? Am I losing my mind? And then I understood that Dad and I were square. And that's been a long time ago. And it's now, if it never got better than that would be great. But I'm here to tell you that it can and does. And there's a difference between my world and God's world. Because it turns out I'm a type, one of the physical thing limitations, I'm a type 2 diabetic, and that means I've got a pancreas that produces plenty of insulin, but my receptors are damaged. And so my body doesn't use the insulin. And it turns out that ever since I was so big, I grew up, I understand today, as a kid that was bathed in love, but it never seemed like there was enough or it wasn't the right kind or anything else. Because my receptors were damaged and I couldn't do it. And so bit by bit through this process, you and God have woken me up to all the love that I've received over my life. And I want to tell you and make you a promise that time in the grave does not change love. Love that my father gave me 40 and 50 years ago that I was not able to understand or accept is just as sweet and valuable today as it was then. And a number of years ago, I was cutting Linda's grass for her. She tells me that I needed to stay close and perform her work well. And I was taking a break, and you know, the smell of the fresh cut grass and sweating, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting there taking a break, and I'm 7 years old, and I'm sitting on my dad's knees, and I swear to God, I can smell the sweat on him, and he's running his hand through my hair, and he's saying, "Boy, I sure do love you." Believe what you will, it was real to me. And I know it happened. I know it happened. A piece of that love cycled back and got me. And I know there's more to get if I'll allow it to happen. The last piece I'll talk to you about is I was in a relationship, not a marriage, but a relationship with a woman for 5 years during my drinking. And Jan had two small kids when I showed up, Summer and Erica. They were 2 years old and 4 years old when I came on the scene. And we were together for 5 years. And I was kind of their alcoholic upgrade. Their biological dad was, I congratulated myself that I was better. He was a violent drunk. He was a biker. And the last time the kids saw him, he found Jan and the girls sitting in a car outside a supermarket. They'd been shopping, and he was angry they'd spent money on food. And he took a length of chain and smashed all the windows out of the car and left those kids covered with broken glass and got on his bike and rode off and was never seen again, actually. Found out from his folks he ended up in Arizona. And so I arrived driving a new Mark V and wearing a cashmere coat, and I've got a bottle of Bordeaux under my arm instead of a six-pack, but I'm still an alcoholic, and I'm causing damage here. And so for 5 years I tornadoed through the lives of those kids and Jan. Jan was a hairstylist then, still is today, and while our relationship ended, she still trims my hair before I go to do these things. As a matter of fact, she asked me to tell you that it's a measure of God's love that she can have me in a barber's chair with a razor near my throat. And I get out alive. But I figured Jan's going to be the easy amend. You know, because, you know, we've stayed cordial over the years after the original breakup. So I sit her down and I go through the process. And the process, I'm told, the first thing you're going to hear from me when I'm making amends is that you're square with me. I cannot come to you holding something against you. That math doesn't work. And because, as my ex-wife said, "Mike, you're the kind of guy who puts rocks and snowballs," I need to let you know so you can hear me. I need to tell you up front that you're square with me. And then the next thing you're going to hear is that I was wrong. Not that I was sorry. Not an apology. I was wrong. And I thought that was awful picky that they insist on that word. And I can't tell you the number of times that I made amends to people and said, you know, Mike, I've known you for 20 years and I've heard you say you were sorry a million times. I never just heard you flat out admit you were wrong about anything. You always had a reason, an excuse, an explanation. So you're going to hear from me. You're square with me. I was wrong. And then what I did. And then because I'm so selfish and self-centered, I know what I did, but I don't know what it did to you, how it affected you. I may have missed something. Tell me about that and tell me what, if anything, I can do to square things between us. And then I shut up and I listen and I do not defend myself or explain myself. I'll answer a question if you ask it. And if I don't have the answer, I don't tell a lie. I say, I have to go talk to my sponsor. I get back to you. So I did this with Jan, and I got to the part where, you know, tell me what you have to say. And she says, well, I see by this time I'm married. I've got a young stepson with that marriage. And she says, I see you bring Andrew into the barber shop, and I can tell by the way he acts around you that he loves you a great deal and that you're a good dad and all that kind of stuff. And I'm waiting for my pat on the back for a good dad. And she said, and that really pisses me off. She says, my girls deserve that from you, and you didn't give it to them. You ripped them off. And then she went on to explain in more detail how the cow ate the cabbage there. And she and I got square, and then I said at the end, well, obviously, Jan, I need to do something to square things with the girls. And by this time, the girls are like early teenagers. And she said, well, I don't know if I want you to have anything to do with them. They don't have all bad memories of that time, so maybe we ought to just leave that alone. And we talked about it some more, and so eventually she agreed that what I should do is write them a letter. And if they wanted to do anything about it, that would be up to them. And I've since found with the men I sponsor, and I've worked with a lot of guys in the men's, I didn't know it really when I was doing this, but kids often really, really, really benefit from having something in writing. They have to, sometimes it takes a month or 2 months or a year to process something or think about it. And the kid that you think that you gave the letter to or whatever, you think you're being ignored, but it's in a special place. Kids keep those letters. They don't throw them away. And you'll hear about them later. And I want to tell you, first of all, I wasn't smart enough to write this letter. I held the pen and I wrote it, and I would take it back to sponsor, and sponsor, red pencil, red pencil, red pencil, and then, you know, another draft. So this is about draft number 6. Dear Summer, I'm writing to do what I can to set right the harm that I did during the years that I was in relationship with your mom. I'm choosing to type this rather than phone for 2 reasons. First, because my handwriting is pretty hard to read, and second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at later when life may be treating you rough. To tell the truth, I'm tempted to let things just stay the way they are because your mom tells me that you have a few good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I love you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, I've done you harm. I'm sure that you're aware during those years we were together, I was an active alcoholic. They made me put this next part in bold italics. Let me be very clear that this in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions. I used alcohol and drugs because they were the only things I knew that could give me relief from the constant fear I felt. I was drawn to you and the family because I desperately wanted to love and be loved, but I was also scared to death at the prospect of being responsible, especially to others. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what was real. Is the real Mike the one who wants to love me, or the one who pushes me away? You weren't crazy. I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What I gave you instead was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy. You were. I know at some deep emotional level, it's hard not to feel that if you were really worthy and valuable, that these things wouldn't have happened to you. Please believe me that this just isn't so. You are worthy and deserving of love both then and now. It was I that failed you. Summer, I hope you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms I've done you. Should you ever want to talk about any of this, please give me a call. If I can ever be of any help to you as a friend, I'd be honored. And then P.S., I'm also sending a similar letter to Erica since I've also harmed her. And the letter was sent and didn't really hear anything for a while. And I did get invited to her high school graduation, and I went. And that was a nice event. And then that fall, we got word from Arizona that Summer always called him her bio dad. Bio dad had died an alcoholic death on a couch in a flop house in Phoenix. He'd hemorrhaged to death from esophageal varices, so he's sucking on a bottle of vodka. And she called me up and she said, Mike, do you remember that letter you sent me? And I said, sure I do, Summer. And she said, part of me always hoped I'd get a letter like that someday from my dad. But since he'll never be able to send it, I think God had you send it for him. And I got to see here, what I really am here, this really isn't about Mike Lorenz. This is about, it's about, will I be part of God's recycling plan? What happens is I'm a man, I've always had good intentions. I never wanted to hurt people. I go out and live life from a selfish, self-centered point of view, and I cause harm, and I terrify children and do all of this stuff and create all this harm and garbage in the world. Now the question becomes, if I will put this in God's hands and allow Him to recycle it, in God's hands it can be turned into an instrument of healing for some guy I never really ever met or knew. I got to go to her wedding a couple years later. And I'll let her tell you how it was. Michael, thank you for sharing my day with me. It seems like just yesterday you were chasing me around and bopping me with those foam bats. Those were great times. I'm glad you're here to see me all grown up on my special day. It wouldn't have been the same without you. Hope your holidays are wonderful. Please keep in touch. Love and kisses, Summer. She and that husband moved to England for his job. And a couple years later, she's pregnant and going to have her first baby, and she wants to be near mom back in the States and not in England when she delivers. And so she came back to Indianapolis, and I got to be number three to hold little Aiden when he was born. And it's gone on and on over the years. Now we've got a new challenge. In September, we found out that Summer has a stage 3 form of genetic breast cancer. And she says, another gift from my dad. and she's going through a double mastectomy, hysterectomy, radiation, and chemo because of the progression of it. But she's facing all of that with great spirit and great optimism. Younger sisters are different. The other one doesn't want to know, doesn't want to be tested, doesn't want, you know. I'm sorry, that's Summer's problem. I'm going to tell you, you know, she was, when I found out about that, I was at a retreat in Hawaii, and somebody asked me what was wrong, and I told them the email I'd gotten and so forth, and related to her. And I said, Summer, you never want to tell a monk you're spiritually depressed, because they start all kinds of things happening. And the next thing we knew, we had a international prayer chain going for her. And she loves that. I'm here to tell you that I'm the crazy guy at closing time used to be banging my head and my fist on the bar, screaming, it's not fair, it's not fair. And I'm here to tell you from the bottom of my heart today, thank God it's not fair. Thank you.